Okay, welcome back to another edition. It's officially an edition. We've done enough of these. It's an edition of Spirit of the Game. This is Ed Mate.
And Lewis Harry.
And we're going to debrief some Masters. I don't know. A lot of people think this Masters was kind of a snoozer. That's debatable, but we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about the rules, which are never a snoozer, right? The rules are always great.
Yeah, I'm always up for it.
So, from a rules vantage point, there was really one notable ruling, and that was Scottie Scheffler, hole 18, ball unplayable, left of the 18th fairway, got a lot of attention because there was nobody left on the course. This was Saturday's round. He's leading the tournament. A lot of speculation about how big a lead is he going to have coming into Sunday. So needless to say, a lot of attention, a lot of eyes on that.
Well, not and, just eyes, I think, all cameras were
right
on that. Right. Too, because no one else on the golf course. This is the final hole, third round. So the only place a camera could be pointing was at Scottie Scheffler at that point.
That's right. And again, what I loved about this ruling was the layers. Because so many times, you get called into a rule situation and you say, I made a ruling. There was at least six rulings I counted in that event, the events surrounding that, at least maybe more. And I'm not a rules number guy, but just for fun, I went back and started looking at all the different rule numbers that came into play there. So when you're a rules official, yeah, I could give relief for an unplayable. So when that official, and I don't know who it was, said, what was the ruling on 18? Oh, it was unplayable. No, it wasn't just unplayable. It was, there was layers to that. So let's start with the basics. And I'm going to be the player. So I'm going to be Scottie Scheffler and you be the rules official. Mm-hmm. And I hit my ball left. I'm going to ask you a series of questions and you can answer them for me. Okay. And we'll see if we do as good a job as they did at the Masters. So first question, that ball left, I hit it left. I don't know if it's my ball. So first question, can I go ahead and declare it unplayable? Because I see a ball there.
So the first thing that comes up, obviously a ball's there and we know a ball's there, but the first question about can we declare that ball unplayable is we have to identify that ball as ours first. The only option that is given to us for an unplayable ball that we don't identify as ours is stroke and distance. So to take any other option with unplayable, whether that's back on the line or lateral relief, we have to identify that ball as our golf ball to use those options.
Okay. Second question. I want to declare it unplayable, but let's just say, let's see, that was he playing with Cameron Smith at that point?
Or he was playing with Charles Schwartzel.
Okay, right,
round.
Right. How quickly we forget about Charles Schwartzel. What if Charles said, I don't think he can declare that unplayable. He has to play that. What would you say if that didn't happen? What if it did?
Well, as many things in our game and the rules kind of come up, it's ultimately up to the player. The player is the one who decides that ball is unplayable and that he's going to invoke his options under Rule 19. And his opponent in match play or any other player in stroke play, has no bearing on whether that player can make that decision.
Okay, so final sort of 30,000 foot point about unplayable. So only the player can declare their ball unplayable. Is there any time in golf where you are not allowed to declare a ball unplayable?
Well, unplayable has a lot of options and it has a lot of leeway. However, we can declare a ball unplayable anywhere on the golf course except for a penalty area. When our ball is in a penalty area, only options at our disposal are the options under 17.1D. So anytime you're on the golf course and your ball's in play, you can declare that ball unplayable.
Except when it's in the penalty area.
Except for when it's in a penalty
and
area.
With, at the risk of getting us deep into the penalty area, why is that? Can you give us a quick answer on why can't I declare my ball? I have my thoughts on it, but I'd love yours.
Mm-hmm. Well, my thoughts are is that penalty areas are these specific areas of the golf course that when you get into those areas, your options become limited. We can always play the ball as it lies. It's one of our core principles of the game of golf, except when our ball's in a no-play zone, but we're getting on another street there. So you can always play the ball as it lies, but to get your ball out of those penalty areas, you're going to have to take a penalty under certain rules. Now, for those rules, we have a whole rule designated around penalty areas, Rule 17. The rules are only going to give us those specific options to get our ball out of that penalty area. Rule 19 is for different scenarios, but when our ball is in those designated penalty areas. Now, they're a little bit different than water hazards used to be. You know, nowadays, anything can become a penalty area, but the penalty areas are there to give you a specific set of options under one specific rule to get your ball in play and back and proceeding along the golf course. And unplayable ball just isn't part of that. It gives you similar options, somewhat not the same, but the biggest thing with the penalty area options is they all use reference points that are based on where your ball may have crossed that edge of the penalty area. Now, with an unplayable ball, the only really reference point is where the ball lies. Mm-hmm. So the reference point's changing a little bit. The options are changing a little bit. So it's just it's not exactly apples to oranges there.
Yeah, no, I think you hit on it. I think you're creating a scenario. I think if you were allowed to declare a ball unplayable in the penalty area where a player was given a choice. And I think we work really hard in the rules not to give – we want to give players options, but not choices, subtle distinction, where you can say weigh one against the other or kind of do a little cost-benefit analysis of which option is best. So we'll leave it there because that one, again, good philosophical discussion. All right, let's get back to our 18th hole. Scotty has declared the ball unplayable. He's looking at his options. Take us through, once the ball was identified, what those options were for him.
Well, he's got three essential options. The first option is stroke and distance. We can take stroke and distance anywhere on the golf course where there are balls.
Not a particularly good option. He's going back to the tee, having to re-hit that shot up the chute.
Okay. So, yeah, 18 being a 465-yard hole or whatever it is, and he's probably already laying down there close to 300. You know, losing the 300 yards he's already taken on that hole is not a good option.
So right.
Second option is comes back on the line, keeping that point where the ball lies and the flag stick, going back on the line as far as he would like. It looks like that option is going to push him further back in the bushes mm-hmm. or into the trees. And to get to a point where he wasn't interfered by those bushes, it might have taken him back onto hole number 10 at that point. So it's, again, not a good option. So it really leaves him with our third option, which is lateral relief. So our two club length relief area in any direction, no closer to the hole, dropping him that two club lengths to the left of him probably, again, pushes him deeper into those trees. So he really is limited on where that direction of those two club lengths is going to take him.
Right. So a key point here, I make this point all the time in rule seminars, when you're declaring a ball unplayable and you're measuring, your reference point is the ball's location, not the edge of the bush, the tree. There is no such thing as nearest point of relief when you're dealing with unplayables. It's where the ball lies. So I see this all the time where players are in a deep scrub oak here, which is common here in Colorado, and they'll start measuring their two club lengths from the edge of the bush. So he barely got out of dodge with those two. He was really on the edge, but okay. So,
actually brings up a good point too. And I think if you watch the broadcast on Saturday during the round, I think one of the first things that Scotty mentioned to that rules official that was on the scene was, you know, something about, well, I'm entitled to take a stance, aren't I?
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
And, you know, in this scenario, you know, yes, we're still entitled to take a fair stance, but that stance isn't guaranteeing anything mm-hmm. in this scenario. And when we're talking about the unplayable ball relief, the stance isn't part of our equation once we get to that point. Right. So it was interesting to hear, you know, something about Scotty wondering about his stance, but really, well, once we got further down the road.
Right. And you think about how easily the rules get blended and terminology like complete relief get misapplied. So when you're taking complete relief from an obstruction, you have to take complete relief. So I could hear a player say, well, I haven't gotten complete relief. That's right.
That's there is no perfect example there of knowing your definitions.
Yeah.
Because the definition of nearest point of complete relief only really covers four distinct things: a normal course conditions, no play zones, wrong greens. I'm forgetting one more. Well, I think maybe dangerous animal conditions, I think, is the fourth one. But nowhere in that definition of nearest point of complete relief do we find the words unplayable lie.
That's right. Okay, so he's chosen an option. He's declared it unplayable. He's measured his two club lengths. Now, next question. Can I substitute the ball? Do I have to play the Titleist 7 or can I play the Titleist 8?
you are completely allowed to substitute a ball. Prior to 2019, he still would have been allowed to substitute the ball since it was penalty relief. But now with the new rules of golf as of 2019, we can substitute a ball anytime we're taking relief, whether it's free or penalty.
Right. So here we go. We're in one ruling, and we've already asked a number of different sort of tangential questions. Okay, next question. I'm going to drop it at knee height. We know that. Now, the ball, I got several texts about this for people who have either forgotten that we changed the rules in 2019, that the ball now has to remain inside the relief area. So I'm kind of not asking a question. I'm making a statement here. He dropped it, and both times the ball rolled outside of the relief area. And prior to 2019, that ball was in play as long as it didn't roll into one of the seven situations that required a redrop. Mm-hmm. Now it's much simpler. If it rolls out, it's no good and do it again.
Well, now, even going further than that now, and I believe both of his, with the rules official saying there, I believe both of his first drops met this requirement. But even more so than keeping a ball in the relief area, the ball has to impact the relief area on the drops. Because if it doesn't meet that requirement, you don't fulfill that part of the drop, then it's not a correct drop, and you have no limit to how many times you can incorrect.
Right. That's what we used to call a no drop.
Yep.
It's just a didn't happen. So he does that. So there's another question that came up. Now that the ball has rolled outside of it, what do we do next? It's rolled. He's dropped it. He's redropped it. Walk us through the procedure once you have done those two things, dropped and redropped, how you get the ball back in play.
Once we've made two drops with, we're dropping from knee height, the ball is impacting our relief area in the relief area. It is rolling outside the relief area. After those two drops, we're going to place it in the relief area. But just because we're placing it doesn't mean we have the whole relief area still at our disposal. Wherever our second drop impacted the ground in the relief area, that's where we're going to go back to the placing of that ball. So really, on Scotty Scheffler's second redrop, that was when he had to think more carefully about where he wanted this ball dropped in the relief area, because in the event that the ball rolled out again, and it did, that was essentially going to become the point where we're placing that ball. It's not a replace. Like a lot of people on Twitter kind of got that mixed up. We weren't replacing the ball because the ball didn't occupy that spot originally. We're replacing the ball. It's a little bit different. So we're placing the ball in that exact spot, estimating that spot where that second drop hit the relief.
Well, this is really important. I'm glad you mentioned it, because I was going to go there. Place versus replace. Because the other thing that looked odd. Oh, and we missed an important one. We'll go back to it. And that was probing the relief area for tree roots. So we'll come back to that. Let's stay with the placing versus replacing. Because it appeared, I had several people ask me, well, it looks like he's placed it closer to the hole. Now, that may or may not be, again, but explain the difference between replacing a ball, and you touched on it there, and placing a ball. It's a subtle concept, but it's important.
So it is different, and they're the same action, right? We're putting a ball down without dropping it down on an exact spot or a spot on the golf course, but there is a difference between replacing and placing. When we're replacing a ball, it's usually after a ball has been marked, lifted out of play, and now we're returning it to play on that exact spot. 99% of the time, under the rules of golf, when we're replacing a ball on a spot, there's no substitution allowed. We have to use the original ball, and it has to go back on that original spot. If not, we're going to look into a situation where we might be playing from a wrong place, but that's kind of the gist of replacing. Now, when we're placing a ball, we talk about placing, the ball hasn't been in a spot previously. So it wasn't
marked. You're going to establish a new spot.
It wasn't marked and lifted from the
golf course. Think of it as a birth of a lie.
Correct.
This lie has not been born yet. You're creating it.
Correct. So it hasn't been lifted from the golf course to be put back on the golf course. It's being put on the golf course, maybe not for the first time, but for a time. And there's some different things that we can do when we're replacing that we can't do when we're placing. But there's some things we can do when we're placing that we can't do when we're replacing. And one of those things has to do with loose impediments in this case. And this is kind of where it's going. One of the big things that kind of lit a fire on Twitter was what Scottie Scheffler was doing with the loose impediments. In this case, it was pine straw. Now, when we're dropping a ball in a relief area, or we're going to drop a ball in a relief area, we can move loose impediments. We can, you know, take them out of that relief area. We can usually remove loose impediments more often than not on the golf course. There's times where we can't. One of the times we can't remove loose impediments is when we're replacing a ball. So if I was to replace a ball on a specific spot and I removed a loose impediment from that specific spot, that would have caused the ball to move had the ball been there. Well, I can't do that. That's one of the limitations for loose impediment removal under 15.1. Now, when I'm placing the ball, again, the ball's not being replaced on an exact spot that it occupied before. When I'm placing the ball, what I can do with loose impediments still applies to as if I was dropping or any other time on the golf course. So in this case, with Scottie Scheffler removing those pieces of pine straw, there was no limitation to him removing those loose impediments, even when it became time to place that golf ball.
Fascinating. Because honestly, as I was watching it, I did hear the comment. I kind of got ahead of myself. I was so focused on the drop. Forgot to cover, can you remove loose impediments in an area in which you are going to drop or place a ball? And the answer is yes. We spoke over the weekend because I was a little bit confused myself, not unusual, on how much is there a limit? Can he sweep away every single one of those? I mean, literally take his arm, his forearm, and just scoop it all out of there and end up with a bare lie. And that would have been very much in his, I mean, he'd much prefer that. And instead of the vagaries of ball sitting on pine straw, can be react much less predictably than on bare earth. These guys can give them concrete, they're fine. Even balls and divots, as long as they can get clean contact on the back of the ball, the professional player, their biggest challenge is unknown and inconsistent, deep rough, wind, things that create uncertainty. So why couldn't he simply just sweep every single one of those little pine needles away and place them on the bare dirt?
Well, this kind of goes back to our definitions in the rules of golf. And as we know, pine straw is under the definitions a loose impediment. However, what's under that pine straw is not a loose impediment under the rules of golf. And that's sand and loose dirt. Soil. Dirt,
yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
I don't know if Augusta wants us to call it dirt. We'll call it soil.
It's not dirt at Augusta.
We'll call it soil to appease the powers that be. But so under the definitions, sand and loose soil are not loose impediments. So, you know, if a player takes that act of sweeping all those pine straw pieces away and all those pine needles away, in that action, you know, a pile of loose dirt goes with them. Well, then we have a problem. What happens there is now we have a breach of, I believe, 8.1A.
I'm sure eight. One of our listeners, many listeners will check you out on that. 8.1.
I'm sure they are. 8.1, A or B, take your pick. One of them talks about what you're allowed to do. One of them talks about what you're not allowed to do. But either way, when your ball is in the general area and, we have these conditions that affect our stroke, removing or pressing down sand or loose soil in the general area is a penalty. That triggers the general penalty under Rule 8.1. And had Scotty picked up a handful of loose sand or soil and with those pine needles, he probably would have been looking at a penalty in that scenario.
Yeah. I like that distinction. And I mentioned to you that Ian Poulter, for those who saw it two or three years ago at the Players' Championship, right of 18, very similar situation, took an unplayable pine straw. He was very aggressive in what he moved, and he effectively was scooping large amounts of pine needles right down to the bare bone earth, and it looked pretty funny. But he had an incredible shot and ended up saving par. It was an amazing thing. But anyway, okay, so let's go back and pick up Scotty's ruling here. So he has declared the ball unplayable. He's chosen a relief option. Let's talk about probing. Another question that was asked, can he use a tee, and was worried about tree roots? Mm-hmm. So talk through us about what you can test and what you can't test, and just anything to be leery or careful about in that situation.
So I said probing, because I believe probing is the terminology they use in the rule book for this scenario. But Under 8.1, again, there's an interpretation, I believe it's interpretation-7. It talks about a player being able to probe the ground to check for tree roots.
I think in that situation,
stuff like that, that's under the surface.
And it's interesting because I looked at that interpretation, and it says when a player's ball lies on the course or something like that. And I said, well, the player's ball doesn't lie on the course. Not yet. So if you were really, really down in the weeds on this and looking at the letter of the law, you'd say, no, wait a minute, where does it say that a player can probe and test and when the ball's not in play? The ball was not in play and he's testing. So that could give him information on where he's best, you know, where he should ultimately choose within the relief area.
Possibly. And to that point about, you know, if you really want to boil it down to how the rules read out, someone out there is probably steaming mad that you can't call in rules violations anymore via telephone, because I'm sure someone would have probably been all over that one.
Yeah.
But it, again, back to that interpretation, they are allowed to do that. Now, that the one caveat in that interpretation that talks about the probing is by doing that, by probing that surface or that ground to check for those tree roots, you can't, you still can't improve any of your conditions affecting the stroke. If by probing so much into that ground to check for those tree roots that you've somehow changed any of your conditions affecting the stroke, your lie, your, the area of your stance, the area of your swing. If some of those conditions had been changed otherwise, as, you know, as we talked about in any of our other restrictions under 8.1, well, then we're still going to get a penalty.
Right.
We can't just go probing all over the place, sticking things in the ground and changing everything. We still have to do it in a careful manner. So we just be aware that if any of you are in your men's league or women's league out there that are starting to probe for tree roots be aware.
Another question we get a lot is a tree root ground under repair? And it seems like they should be because they're dangerous. But no is the answer. There's no hard and fast definition that says a tree root by definition is ground under repair. Where you hear tree roots, and by the way, shout out to the rules app. Man, that thing is awesome. Type in tree root and you get all the interpretations, rules, definitions related to those keywords. So much better than trying to pour through a book, because I tried it. It's been a while. I'm a little rusty. But the main reference you see with tree roots is ground under repair, abnormal ground conditions, where you have a tree root growing out of an area that's been marked as ground under repair, and whether or not that is part of the ground under repair, because anything rooted in ground under repair vertically upward, but the moment it leaves the area, it's no longer ground under repair. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct. Yeah. So, and most of the times we encounter ground under repair on our golf course, it's usually marked with enclosed lines in an enclosed area. So it usually only encompasses the things that are enclosed within that certain area and what we define as GUR.
So. Right. So the final verdict on this. So Scottie Scheffler declares the ball unplayable, gets a one stroke penalty, hits a miraculous shot, or just a very good shot. I wouldn't say miraculous, but a very good shot, saves five, really changed the tenor. Or, you know, it was actually, there's good bogeys and bad bogeys. That was a good bogey. He walked off that green very, very happy. He was not disappointed. It did not take any wind out of his sails. As a rules official, having worked that hole, I felt very badly for the rules official, because that's a no-win situation. When you're in a situation there, and I told myself, if I was ever in a situation, and you know it when the camera's there, you know, you'd have to be pretty tone deaf not to know everybody's watching this ruling. I told myself, because he had a lot of time. By the time this is kind of inside the rules official's head, when that ball went left, they found it right away. I promise you, because there's spotters everywhere. Okay. I would have immediately gotten on the radio and said, I need a rover on 18 left landing zone, drive zone. What is it? Just come over. Cause I don't want to be on camera. I do not want to be that guy. And I think it was a European rules official.
I think what I was reading on Twitter, I think he was one of the rules officials. Either he was an RNA guy or he was a European tour official.
Yeah. And it's funny. It's so funny how rulings tend to strike twice, where you get the same guy. A good friend of mine, Ken Tackett, is a former executive director of the West Virginia Golf Association. He's a rules official on the PGA Tour now. And there's been weeks where there was last year at the Masters, it was the Ken Tackett turn. He had Abraham Answers ball. he had like three or four rulings all on camera. And I texted him and said, Ken, it's not all about you. Well, whoever it was, the next day, as we transitioned into another same rules official, was walking on hole three, was walking through, I think it was Cameron Smith. It was either him or Scotty, because they both had. So let's talk about.
I believe they were both.
But it, sure enough, it was the same rules official. I got, man, this guy is in the either the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time. For my money, you do not want to be a famous rules official, because if you make a perfect ruling, nobody's going to give you an award for that. But boy, are they going to come down on you if you mess it up. So I would have never been put myself in that situation.
Yeah. And going back to, you know, you're saying as soon as that ball goes left, you're probably calling for backup or another rules official. But it really, in any rules official's mind, when that ball is going left, you're thinking of one or two things. You're thinking it's going to be an unplayable ball.
Yeah.
Or it's going to be, you know, we're one.
Yeah.
We find the ball first. And once we find the ball, you know.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Fair point.
Immediately, you're just going to rule.
Yeah, I would have, in hindsight being 2020, I might have said, I got this one. How hard is an unplayable? It's one of the easiest rulings in golf. There's nothing to it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, okay. So let's fast forward to Sunday. Really the pivotal hole of the whole tournament, frankly, as it turned out. Both Cameron Smith and Scottie Scheffler hit it left. I've worked hole three, which is a fabulous hole, more than any other hole. The three times I was there, I got assigned three a lot. Mm-hmm. What a great golf hole. The risk and reward of trying to drive the green, lay it up. I mean, it did make some changes to the green that I think made it even more interesting. And I'm very familiar with the spot that both of them drove to, which was always the one area that you really have to pay attention to as a rules official, because there is a scoreboard. I think it's what they call a through board, because I think it only shows the three players or the two players who were what their status is through, hence the word through board, through that hole. And I had one ruling there. It was with Bryson DeChambeau, and he drove it not nearly as far left as Scott, or not as far left as Scottie Scheffler, but in a similar vicinity. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is all the hole marshals or whatever they call them, they know the rules. They've been working that hole forever. So before, by the time I got over there, they'd already cleared out the patrons from the area where, and it looked kind of odd. I'm like, why are they clearing the patrons out there? Well, they knew exactly where his relief was going to be because they've seen it happen a million times. And sure enough, they couldn't have been more accurate. By the time we dealt with the temporary immovable obstruction rule, they were correct. So let's talk about TIOs, temporary immovable obstructions. Dangerous topic to get into this late in our little weekly, because it's very.
Yeah, this could be a real huge rabbit hole to go down, but we'll try and keep it succinct.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So you've got two balls. Deal with the easy one first, Cameron Smith.
So Cameron Smith, this one kind of goes, you know, I don't want to call it simple because, you know, there's no simple rulings ever. You know, everything has an underlayer, but really Cameron Smith, he hit his ball roughly in the general area. I hate to use that term general area too, because, you know, as we know, it's a definition of the rules of golf, but they're left on three. Cameron Smith, he's just going to get normal. I believe he just got normal immovable obstruction relief.
Yeah, it looked to me like he 16. Had obstruction from, it might have been even something on the ground that was supporting the, maybe a,
It might have been a drain. It might have been a vent for the sub-air system. I'm not sure what it was, but under 16, he just got regular movable obstruction relief. You know, he kind of just moved all of his, you know, conditions off there. Nearest point of complete relief. You know, he gets to a spot where he drops.
And again, for clarity, he was in front of the TIO. And this is when you get into the nuances of TIOs. You have in front of, you have drip lines, you have all kinds of. And before we go any further on, temporary immovable obstructions. These are things that are there only for the week. These are things that are not permanent. They're not. And one of the uniquenesses about Augusta National is much of their infrastructure is permanent because they host it every year. When you go to a U.S. Open, they erect a temporary city on top of the golf course. There's a lot of TIOs. One of the beauties of officiating at Augusta, there's very few TIOs and they're way out of play. So, for example, 9 and 18 holes that normally strike fear in the heart of a rules official because they know they're going to be dealing with TIOs because of all the grandstands and corporate hospitality and all this, none of it, zero. All they have is grass. And I was so relieved when I got signed to hole nine, and I'm looking at the hole and I'm like, oh man, this is going to be bad. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm at Augusta. There is no TIOs. So anyway, in the case of three, Scheffler is behind it and the TIO is in between him and the hole, but also in between him and the hole is a whole bunch of trees. How does that change the ruling?
Well, let's talk about trees real quick, because that's an easy one to address. Trees are there no matter what. You know, trees are, they're natural objects on a golf course, and there's no relief from trees, even if they're a temporary tree, if they're a permanent tree that's been there for hundreds of years. Trees are trees. They're natural objects. Nothing about that. In the term of the TIO, you know, it follows along the same lines as an immovable obstruction. You know, we get all the same interference as in immovable obstruction. We get the lie of the ball, our stance, our area of our intended swing. But the thing with TIOs, and this is, you know, what some people have a hard time with and what some people don't agree with TIOs, is we get a fourth element that comes back into play with our TIO relief. And that's obviously the line of sight with a player. Now, with Scottie Scheffler, where he was behind that TIO, and with the TIO being between him and, you know, where he was going to the green, he was given some pretty generous relief for that obstruction because of where that line kind of interfered with, you know, where he was going, where he intended to play that ball. So that, and some people like to refer to this as, it got him out of jail, essentially. Mm-hmm. It kind of bailed him out from having to deal with anything with that temporary movable obstruction. Now, if that was a green sprinkler box in his way, well, too bad.
Right.
The green sprinkler box, you know, but just because it was in between him and the hole, would have had no bearing on where that nearest point of complete relief was. Because of that scoreboard or that through board, as we were saying, because of that status as a TIO, well, that introduced a different element to it. And of course, that changed where that relief area was going to become for that TIO. Now, we can also make the argument that, like Ed said, that a lot of that infrastructure at Augusta is permanent. It's year round. You know, whether you're playing in the Masters or you're playing with a member in December, you're probably going to see that same piece of infrastructure as you go through that hole. Whether we want to classify that as a temporary movable obstruction, well, that's not my place to say. The competitions committee at Augusta, they can define that however they would like. That was how they chose to define it.
So one of the interesting nuances in the TIO ruling is, TIO rule is, it has to intervene between you and the hole, not in between you and the direction you wish to play. So again, yeah. Very different concept than... you know, you don't have the reasonable judgment quite this. You kind of do, because if there was a forest in front of you, there's no way a ball could get through that forest for it to get to the TIO. In this case, I think it was a correct ruling, because we saw how many times players over the course of the week punch it out of these little tiny windows. And there was a window in there. And I promise you, he probably would have gone that way had it not been. So there was definitely interference under the TIO ruling. One of the more notable, I remember when it happened, John Vandeville, 1999 Open Championship. You probably weren't even born in 99. That's how old I am, or how young you are. Anyway, he was at the Carnoustie. His ball was in the hay, and he wanted to chip out sideways to the fairway. Well, in between him and the fairway, not in between him and the hole, was a huge TV tower. Got relief. Wrong. The walking official blew it. And he was able to take it out of the Carnoustie hay into a pretty good spot, knock it on the green. It was a huge break. So maybe the golfing gods got, if you know how that story ended.
Well,
when I saw it happening, I thought, oh, that seems right. Because the TIO was on the, it was a very reasonable play out sideways. There's no way he would have tried to go for the green from this lie. He would have just gotten it back to, you know, something reasonable. Mm. So anyway, the point is, it has to be between you and the hole, not just in the direction you want to play.
As two things popped in my head as you were saying there too. You know, a lot of people have the issue with TIO relief, and you know, they think it, you know, gives too much to the player. But this isn't a new concept, as you mentioned. TIOs have been around, and they've been part of our, you know, part of tournament golf for a long time now. And this isn't like something that popped up overnight, like some people like to imagine. The other thing I thought about too, and we were talking about, you know, what the interference has to be between the player and, you know, where we're going with the hole, is it's very different than our interference on the putting green. When we're talking about interference on the putting green with an immovable obstruction or an abnormal course condition, we talk about the line of play on the putting green. Here, mm-hmm. it's not necessarily the line of play. We're talking about line of sight with the TIO.
Yeah,
and that's a very different point. Concept.
So if there was a huge amount of break, that would be factored in. Even though it's not a direct line, it's going to include the amount of break you might play.
If Scottie Scheffler, for some reason in that scenario on three during the final round, if he wanted to play a shot that had 40 yards of left to right curvature in it, that wouldn't have mattered so much in that scenario. That's it's really, the way he intended to play that shot wouldn't have factored in as much as that line of sight relief.
Okay, we have one more as we wrap up. And this is kind of just a way to kind of reflect on what brought us into Masters Week, which was your good video on Tiger Woods. So the tournament ended for all intents and purposes on hole 12, as many Masters have ended. Ended there for Greg Norman. It ended there for Brooks Koepka. It ended there for Jordan Spieth in the year when he didn't win. So in this case, it ended for Cameron Smith. So poor Cameron fell victim to the swirling winds of Amen Corner or the aggressive line. And he was trying to win the tournament. So you can't fault him for, taking a chance and going after that flag. But what he chose to do is a kind of a good way to reflect on the Tiger ruling, because he picked a distance, hit the ball in the water, didn't even hit land, by the way. That only crossed the margin or the edge once.
Yeah, that was.
It didn't cross three times.
It wasn't close.
Yeah, it didn't hit. I always point out that's a great example of balls generally cross three times. They cross the first time, they then cross the second time on the green side, and then they bounce and go back in on a third. So your only point that matters is the final time. So in this case, there was only one point. Unlike Tiger, he was not choosing stroke and distance. He chose to pick a yardage. So just explain once again, if you choose that option, how you go about it, and what Cameron Smith did.
So in this scenario, if it just kind of set the stage here, the raised creek there on 12 is marked as a yellow penalty area. As we kind of move into our modernization of the rules of golf and how things are evolving with penalty areas, we're seeing less and less yellow. Nowadays, everything's kind of defaulting to red, but Race Creek on 12 is still marked as yellow penalty area, so it still only leaves a player with two relief options. There is also a drop zone there on 12. I believe the competitions committee has been using a drop zone on 12 there for a number of years. In this case, Cameron Smith didn't elect to use that drop zone, but he elected to use our option for back on the line relief. So taking where that ball last crossed the edge of that penalty area, and where the flag was on the green, he's just going to take a line back between those two points, and it's going to go back as far as he would like. And the scenario,
he could even go back beyond. He'd go longer if he wanted to for some reason.
He could take
it doesn't end at the tee. He could the tee shot was 150, and he for some reason loved 160, and there was a great spot up there. He could choose that.
If he so desired, he could have taken that line all the way back into 14 fairway if he wanted to. But usually when players are taking back on the line relief, they're doing that with a yardage in mind. For whatever shot that Cameron Smith was trying to set up, he wanted to go back on that line as far back. And
I think he should have chosen a spot maybe four or five paces further back than he did, because he had a bear mailing the green.
That's also true. And, in our casual rounds and our, day-to-day rounds, it's easy to choose that yardage, because we can just pull our rangefinder out, zap it, and figure out where we are. But of course, it's not as easy to do when we're playing in a major championship, but chose that line. He's going to choose a spot on that line as far back as he would like. And based on the spot he chooses on that line, he's going to build a one club length relief area, drop it anywhere within that one club length relief area, and then he's going to go about it from there.
Yeah. And again, this is where we can, that's why I love these conversations, because we do the rules videos. We try to knock them out in 2 minutes or less. It's nice not to have a clock on us. And again, if you're still listening, then thank you. You're very dedicated, and maybe you ought to become a CJ Rules official. And if you do, send Lewis Harry an email and he'll send you information. So this is going to change the next time the rules get rewritten, but establishing your reference point when going back on a line, it's highly recommended you put a tee in the ground so you have a reference point. So when the rules were written in 2019, there was no such contemplation. I mean, they did say put a tee in the ground, but they didn't really contemplate what if you don't do that? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, well, then where it's the ball strikes is the reference point. They did contemplate that. Yep. So when a ball strikes the ground and you haven't put a tee in the ground, it rolls forward when proceeding under this line of, you know, direct line on keeping the point between you and the hole and going back. The reference point, if you don't put a tee in the ground, is where it struck the ground. So if it rolls forward an inch and you pick it up and redrop it, you have now picked up a ball in play. So to fix that, they wrote a model local rule that basically creates, if I'm correct, a one club length sort of pivot. Think about basketball where you have your pivot foot and you can go closer to the hole. So
yeah, it's almost like, I like to think of it as a, you know, you still have your one club length relief area and then, you know, that reference point where the ball hits the ground. But I like to think of that area in front of the reference point in this scenario as kind of a grace area. Mm-hmm. You know, we're kind of given some extended relief, you know, to not have a potential penalty there by playing that ball. But it is a model local rule. I believe it's model local rule E12. But that also it's used in high level competitions for that exact rule for those players that don't put a tee in the ground. They proceed with that back on the line relief option.
Yeah. And when this, I was on the rules committee when this change was being suggested and implemented, believe it or not, because I remember this very clearly. I'm trying to remember who the official was, PGA Tour rules official. His name is escaping me at the moment. He said, because the idea was that there would be no limit once you establish that corridor where, okay, you have this one club length relief area. It's actually two club lengths because it's one club length on either side.
Yep.
So it's a two club length wide corridor. They said, what if it rolls 20 yards closer to the hole? They're like, no problem. Like, what? What is that going to look like? So if you could be able to imagine being on a big slope, you pick a spot at 120, you drop it, and it rolls 100 yards closer to the hole, but it hasn't rolled closer than where it last crossed the edge of the penalty area. That ball was okay. So clearly that was going to be. So this was discussed in great length. And the one thing that was not anticipated was players picking up the ball the moment it rolled forward. So the other thing, and you mentioned this final comment for this week's Spirit of the Game, for me anyway, is the marking of the hole. When the rulemakers got together in 2019 or leading up to 2019, a lot of talk about, can we eliminate the yellow options? Let's just make everything red. The 12th hole at Augusta National is the perfect example why that would be a terrible idea. Now, in the case of Cameron Smith, it wouldn't have mattered because he only crossed the edge once. But more often than not, balls hit and drop back in. Well, guess what? Think about where Freddie Couples was in 1990 when his ball miraculously hung up on the edge. That's effectively, and he made a great up and down for par. All of a sudden, what makes that such a catastrophic error is a double bogey. It's pretty much automatic. And matter of fact, as we saw with Cameron Smith, often worse because it's just, you got to do it again from a weird yardage.
Yep. But I mean, the list goes on of people who have made, you know, score worse than four there to essentially seal their fate.
That's right. But if you mark that as red, and a ball hit on that hillside, taking an aggressive line, you will be able to find, by measuring two club lengths no closer to the hole, marking it fairly close to the, you know, wherever that would be, a couple feet up from the edge of the water. Believe it or not, you'd be able to find a spot where you could drop it on the hillside. It would roll back in. You might cost you a sleeve of golf balls. Hey, that's no big deal. You're vying to win a Masters. You do it again. Then you place it on that hillside. Now you have a fairly easy, a straightforward uphill chip trying to get up and down for bogey. Might even hold it for three. So if we change the rules, and when people say we ought to make it just one option, why do we have two? This is why. Number 12 at Augusta.
I'll leave a final thought here as a wrap up, but let's just say in a world where we do get into that red penalty area on 12 at Augusta scenario, and we do have players dropping in this very small slice of ground where their relief area becomes, well, with that hill slope the way it is, we might see Charlie Hoffman part two with the ball rolling back into the penalty area once it's in play.
That's a good point. That would be the golfing gods getting their revenge on it.
There we go.
Well, listen, that wraps up another edition of Spirit of the Game. You have been kind enough to listen to us for 45 minutes. Who are we kidding? Nobody's listened to us this long. But if you have, thanks. We'll be back, I'm sure, soon with another Spirit of the Game.
Till then.